Siri and I came down out of the hills and returned to the festival just before sunrise of the second day. For a night and a day we had roamed the hills, eaten with strangers in pavilions of orange silk, bathed together in the icy waters of the Shri, and danced to the music which never ceased going out to the endless file of passing aisles. We were hungry. I had awakened at sunset to find Siri gone. She returned before the moon of Maui Covenant rose. She told me that her parents had gone off with friends for several days on a slow-moving houseboat. They had left the family skimmer in first sight. Now we worked our way from dance to dance, bonfire to bonfire, back to the center of the city. We planned to fly west to her family estate near Feverone. It was very late, but First Sight Common still had its share of revelers. I was very happy. I was 19, and I was in love, and the 0.93 gravity of Maui Covenant seemed much less to me. I could have flown, had I wished. I could have done anything. We had stopped at a booth and bought fried dough and mugs of black coffee. Suddenly a thought struck me. I asked, "How did you know I was a shipman?" "Hush, friend Merrin. Eat your poor breakfast. When we get to the villa, I will fix a true meal to break our fast." "No, I'm serious," I said, and wiped grease off my chin with the sleeve of my less-than-clean harlequin's costume. "This morning you said that you knew right away last night that I was from the ship. Why was that? Was it my accent? My costume? Mike and I saw other fellows dressed like this." Siri laughed and brushed back her hair. "Just be glad it was I who spied you out, Merrin, my love. Had it been my Uncle Gresham or his friends, it would have meant trouble." "Oh, why is that?" I picked up one more fried ring, and Siri paid for it. I followed her through the thinning crowd. Despite the motion and the music all about, I felt weariness beginning to work on me. "They are separatists," said Siri. "Uncle Gresham recently gave a speech before the council urging that we fight rather than agree to be swallowed into your hegemony. He said that we should destroy your Farcaster device before it destroys us." "Oh," I said. "Did he say how he was going to do that? The last I heard, you folks had no craft to get off-world in." "Nay, nor for the past 50 years have we," said Siri. "But it shows how irrational the separatists can be." I nodded. Shipmaster Singh and Counselor Halman had briefed us on the so-called separatists of Maui Covenant. "The usual coalition of colonial jingoists and throwbacks," Singh had said. "Another reason we go slow and develop the world's trade potential before finishing the Farcaster. The World Web doesn't need these yahoos coming in prematurely. And groups like the Separatists are another reason to keep you crew and construction workers the hell away from the groundlings." "Where is your skimmer?" I asked. The common was emptying quickly. Most of the bands had packed up their instruments for the night. Gaily costumed heaps lay snoring on the grass or cobblestones amid the litter and unlit lanterns. Only a few enclaves of merriment remained, groups dancing slowly to a lone guitar or singing drunkenly to themselves. I saw Mike Osho at once, a patchworked fool, his mask long gone, a girl on either arm. He was trying to teach the Hava Nagila to a rapt but inept circle of admirers. One of the troop would stumble, and they would all fall down. Mike would flog them to their feet among general laughter, and they would start again, hopping clumsily to his basso profundo chant. "There it is," said Siri, and pointed to a short line of skimmers parked behind the common hall. I nodded and waved to Mike, but he was too busy hanging on to his two ladies to notice me. Siri and I had crossed the square and were in the shadows of the old building when the shout went up. "Shipman! Turn around, you hegemony son of a bitch!" I froze, and then wheeled around with fists clenched, but no one was near me. 6 young men had descended the steps from the grandstand and were standing in a semicircle behind Mike. The man in front was tall, slim, and strikingly handsome. He was 25 or 26 years old, and his long blonde curls spilled down on a crimson silk suit that emphasized his physique. In his right hand, he carried a meter-long sword that looked to be of tempered steel. Mike turned slowly. Even from a distance, I could see his eyes sobering as he surveyed the situation. The women at his side, and a couple of the young men in his group, tittered as if something humorous had been said. Mike allowed the inebriated grin to stay on his face.
"You address me, sir?"
he asked.
"I address you, you hegemony whore's son," hissed the leader of the group.
His handsome face was twisted into a sneer.
"Bertol," whispered Ciri, "my cousin, Gresham's younger son."
I nodded and stepped out of the shadows. Ciri caught my arm.
"That is twice you have referred unkindly to my mother, sir," slurred Mike. "Have she or I offended you in some way? If so, 1,000 pardons."
Mike bowed so deeply that the bells on his cap almost brushed the ground. Members of his group applauded.
"Your presence offends me, you hegemony bastard! You stink up our air with your fat carcass!"
Mike's eyebrows rose comically. A young man near him in a fish costume waved his hand.
"Oh, come on, Bertol, he's just—"
"Shut up, Ferrick! It is this fat shithead I am speaking to."
"Shithead?" repeated Mike, eyebrows still raised.
"I've traveled 200 light-years to be called a fat shithead. It hardly seems worth it."
He pivoted gracefully, untangling himself from the women as he did so. I would have joined Mike then, but Ciri clung tightly to my arm, whispering unheard entreaties. When I was free, I saw that Mike was still smiling, still playing the fool. But his left hand was in his baggy shirt pocket.
"Give him your blade, Craig," snapped Bertol.
One of the younger men tossed a sword, hilt first, to Mike. Mike watched it arc by and clang loudly on the cobblestones.
"You can't be serious," said Mike, in a soft voice that was suddenly quite sober. "You cretinous cow-turd! Do you really think I'm going to play duel with you just because you get a hard-on acting the hero for these yokels?"
"Pick up the sword!" screamed Bertol, "or by God I'll carve you where you stand!"
He took a quick step forward, the youth's face contorted with fury as he advanced.
"Fuck off," said Mike.
In his left hand was the laser pen.
"No!" I yelled, and ran into the light.
That pen was used by construction workers to scrawl marks on girders of whiskered alloy.
Things happened very quickly then.
Bertol took another step, and Mike flicked the green beam across him almost casually. The colonist let out a cry and leaped back. A smoking line of black was slashed diagonally across his silk shirt front. I hesitated. Mike had the setting as low as it could go. Two of Bertol's friends started forward, and Mike swung the light across their shins. One dropped to his knees, cursing, and the other hopped away, holding his leg and hooting. A crowd had gathered. They laughed as Mike swept off his fool's cap in another bow.
"I thank you," said Mike. "My mother thanks you."
Ciri's cousin strained against his rage. Froths of spittle spilled on his lips and chin. I pushed through the crowd and stepped between Mike and the tall colonist.
"Hey, it's all right," I said. "We're leaving. We're going now."
"God damn it, Marin, get out of the way," said Mike.
"It's all right," I said as I turned to him. "I'm with a girl named Ciri who has a—"
Bertol stepped forward and lunged past me with his blade. I wrapped my left arm around his shoulder and flung him back. He tumbled heavily onto the grass.
"Oh, shit,"
said Mike as he backed up several paces. He looked tired and a little disgusted as he sat down on a stone step.
"Aw, damn," he said softly.
There was a short line of crimson in one of the black patches on the left side of his harlequin costume. As I watched, the narrow slit spilled over, and blood ran down across Mike Osho's broad belly.
"Oh, Jesus, Mike!"
I tore a strip of fabric from my shirt and tried to staunch the flow. I could remember none of the first aid we'd been taught as midshipmen. I pawed at my wrist, but my comlog was not there. We had left them on the Los Angeles. "It's not so bad, Mike," I gasped. "It's just a little cut." The blood flowed down over my hand and wrist.
"It will serve," said Mike.
His voice was held taut by a cord of pain.
"Damn! A fucking sword! Do you believe it, Marin? Cut down in the prime of my prime by a piece of fucking cutlery out of a fucking one-penny opera. Oh, damn, that smarts!"
"Three-penny opera," I said, and changed hands. The rag was soaked.
"You know what your fucking problem is, Marin? You're always sticking your fucking 2 cents in. Oh!"
Mike's face went white and then gray. He lowered his chin to his chest and breathed deeply.
"To hell with this, kid. Let's go home, huh?"
I looked over my shoulder. Bertol was slowly moving away with his friends. The rest of the crowd milled around in shock.
"Call a doctor!" I screamed. "Get some medics up here!"
2 men ran down the street. There was no sign of Siri.
"Wait a minute! Wait a minute!"
said Mike in a stronger voice, as if he had forgotten something important.
"Just a minute!" he said,
and died. Died. A real death. Brain death. His mouth opened obscenely, his eyes rolled back so only the whites showed, and a minute later the blood ceased pumping from the wound. For a few mad seconds I cursed the sky. I could see the L.A. moving across the fading starfield, and I knew that I could bring Mike back if I could get him there in a few minutes. The crowd backed away as I screamed and ranted at the stars. Eventually I turned to Bertol. "You," I said. The young man had stopped at the far end of the common. His face was ashen. He stared wordlessly. "You," I said again. I picked up the laser pen from where it had rolled, clicked the power to maximum, and walked to where Bertol and his friends stood waiting. Later, through the haze of screams and scorched flesh, I was dimly aware of Ceres' skimmer setting down in the crowded square, of dust flying up all around, and of her voice commanding me to join her. We lifted away from the light and madness. The cool wind blew my sweat-soaked hair away from my neck.
"We will go to Feverone," said Ciri. "Bertol was drunk. The Separatists are a small, violent group. There will be no reprisals. You will stay with me until the Council holds the inquest."
"No," I said.
"There. Land there."
I pointed to a spit of land not far from the city. Ciri landed, despite her protests. I glanced at the boulder to make sure the backpack was still there, and then climbed out of the skimmer. Ciri slid across the seat and pulled my head down to hers.
"Marin, my love."
Her lips were warm and open, but I felt nothing. My body felt anesthetized. I stepped back and waved her away. She brushed her hair back and stared at me from green eyes filled with tears. Then the skimmer lifted, turned, and sped to the south in the early morning light.
"Just a minute," I felt like calling.
I sat on a rock and gripped my knees as several ragged sobs were torn up out of me. Then I stood and threw the laser pen into the surf below. I tugged out the backpack and dumped the contents on the ground. The hawking mat was gone. I sat back down, too drained to laugh or cry or walk away. The sun rose as I sat there. I was still sitting there 3 hours later when the large black skimmer from ship security set down silently beside me.